Hey everyone, before we get started on the show this week, I wanted to let you know, in case you hadn't heard, we have started a new yearly membership option. So some people like the budgeting factor of the monthly membership, and that's great. You get all the benefits of a membership, and some people say, hey, let's take care of this now and get it done for the whole year so I don't have to worry about being recharged by PayPal and stuff like that. So there's an option for both of you. There's the monthly membership, same price it's always been. And then now the yearly membership, which actually gets you essentially 2 free months off of our standard pricing. And if you're an existing member and you go to sign up at the site, and it's pretty obvious you'll be able to see there, where you go to sign up, there's a special place where you click, and there's an explanation how to upgrade your current membership without losing any of your history, your activity in the forums, anything like that. So you lose nothing, and actually you gain if you decide you want to take advantage out of it. And if you don't, that's fine. Just want to let you know that it's there. Thanks so much for being a member of the Paranormal Plus Club. We appreciate it and hope you enjoy the show. The crimes, the criminals, why did they do it? Who got hurt? Did they meet justice or commit the perfect crime? You'll find all the clues at Jim Harold's Crime Scene. Well, welcome to the Crime Scene, and thank you so much for being a part of the Plus Club. I certainly appreciate you signing up and being a part of it and joining in on these podcasts. And I must say, this is a subject that there are a few things when you talk about true crime, a few touchstones, famous cases. And we've covered Jack the Ripper, of course. We talked about the Manson killings. And we're kind of working our way through the tour of the great true crime cases of history. Now, I think this would be a fascinating show if we just talked about this case. I'm talking about the D.B. Cooper case. If we just talked about it circa 5 years ago, where it was at, folks thought it would never be solved. We'd never know who D.B. Cooper really is. Well, that would be fascinating. But I think it's even more fascinating tonight because we have somebody on the line who's done a great deal of research and thinks, fairly certain, that he's found the man who was, in fact, D.B. Cooper. And the man I'm talking about is Robert M. Blevins. He's one of the two managing editors for Adventure Books of Seattle, which has been around since 2001. He spent his early years in San Francisco and later moved to the Seattle area, and his many stops along the way include Midway Island, the Philippines, Guam, Mexico, and Hawaii. And he did a great deal of research for this book that we talked about, Into the Blast, The True Story of D.B. Cooper. It's been featured on television, including Brad Meltzer's Decoded, where I found out about his book. And when Robert is not writing, editing, or wading through submissions, he spends much of his spare time camping, fishing, and hiking in the Great Northwest, that very picturesque part of the country. Robert Blevins, thank you for joining us on the Crime Scene.
You're welcome. Glad to be here.
Now, I think there's been a lot of interest in the D.B. Cooper case over the years, many of us. What got you interested in it?
Well, I remember watching the hijacking on television, actually, in Seattle when I was about 17. That's when it happened. But how I really got into it was a detective in New York City named Skip Porteous sent us a book proposal. He thought he knew who might be the hijacker, and that's how I got involved in it.
And let's go back to the case, because I'm sure that many of our listeners have heard of it, but maybe there are a few out there who haven't, or maybe some people need their memory refreshed. Just take us through the basics, the who, what, and when, and where of the D.B. Cooper case all those years ago.
On Thanksgiving weekend, actually the 24th of November in 1971, a gentleman dressed in black suit with a black tie and an overcoat bought a ticket for $20 to go from Portland, Oregon to Seattle on a Northwest Airlines 727 Boeing jet. And as soon as they got airborne, he got the attention of one of the stewardesses, handed her a note that basically said he had demands, and he would let them know what they were, but that the plane was being hijacked, and if they didn't do what he said, he would set off a bomb he was carrying. He later asked for 4 parachutes and $200,000 in cash, He didn't really specify how the money should be paid, but they actually paid him in bundles of $120 bills each. When they got on the ground in Seattle, they brought the parachutes on board, the money. They took off. He let the passengers go, but he kept the crew, most of them. They took off again, and somewhere between Seattle and Portland, he jumped out, and nobody's ever heard of him again, or the money.
Kind of the temple has been in everything that I've heard, or many of the things that I've heard, is that kind of the conventional wisdom was, this guy didn't survive the jump. He, you know, he was dead in the woods, possibly. Vultures and things swooped down and ate his remains, and we'll never find him. And I know some of the money was found, I believe, in 1980. But wasn't that kind of the template that, except for some people, the official story, didn't it kind of go in that direction, that that's where what ended up happening to D.B. Cooper?
Well, I think the jump was easily survivable. And one reason is because about 6 months after the Cooper hijacking, another gentleman named Richard Floyd McCoy jumped out with more than twice the load that Cooper did, and from 6,000 feet higher at night, and he survived easily, although he was caught later.
Right. But I guess what I was trying to get at is, wasn't the official call, I guess what I'm trying to ask you is this, is didn't kind of the, since they hadn't caught whoever D.B. Cooper was, wasn't the official position, didn't they want people to largely believe that he was dead?
Now they do. That seems to be sort of their opinion, but they didn't really get into that opinion until they found the money on Tina Bar at the Columbia River in 1980. Before that, they were still really looking for him hard. But when they found the $5,800 buried there on the riverbank, then they start saying, well, you know, we think maybe he died in the river.
Now, go ahead.
Well, I don't subscribe to that theory for one really good reason. The amount of money that they found was $5,800, and that's approximately three bundles of the money. Some of the bundles were slightly larger than others, but if the money had fallen out while he was falling, you know, or if he had gone into the river and the money had washed out of the bag somehow, it's really unlikely that three bundles would have been found in the exact same spot.
Right.
You know, that leads to either maybe somebody put it into a paper bag and threw it into the river as a red herring and didn't expect that it would take 8 years to find it, or 9 years, or somebody went there later and deliberately buried it.
So let's, before we get into your theories, which I think are absolutely fascinating, well thought out, just very compelling, let's talk about the myth of D.B. Cooper, because even more so than the actual occurrence and what happened, it's really taken on mythical shape. I mean, there's been songs written about him. There's been movies made about him. There's been many books written about him. He still fascinates. Why have we made him kind of a modern day Robin Hood almost?
I think some of that is because he didn't actually hurt anybody. And later when the FBI got the description of what the bomb looked like, because Florence Stewardess Flo Schaffner actually got a look at it. He showed it to her briefly. And Ralph Himmelsbach says that the FBI agent who was in charge of the case said that there couldn't have been dynamite. He showed her, when he opened up the briefcase, there was a big battery, a bunch of wires, and these red sticks. And Himmelsbach has pointed out repeatedly that dynamite isn't actually red. It's actually more like the color of a manila envelope. They believe they were road flares. So he really didn't have any intention of hurting anybody. And he kind of thumbed his nose at the system and walked away with $200,000, which by today's standards is worth exactly $1,040,000, you know, in 1971 dollars.
Well, if you think about it, it's kind of the ultimate case. And I'm not saying that it's right or anything, but kind of sticking it to the man, as it were.
Yes.
So let's get into your theory. So you got this manuscript from this detective, and you said, this is a very interesting case. I'm going to investigate this. Tell us how you got into it and how you kind of tracked down your key suspect.
Well, he didn't really have a full manuscript. He had some interviews, and he had a lot of information, but there really wasn't anything there that you could really say was a manuscript to make a book out of. But I was interested in the story, and he sent me to the New York Magazine article by Jeffrey Gray. Mr. Gray also suspected that Kenny was the hijacker. After I read it and saw what Porteous had sent me, the first thing I told him was, well, you know, you need to find some of these people that knew Kenny Christensen, and they need to be interviewed. And so he asked me to do the interview since he was in New York and I was already out here. And that's how I got involved.
So let's talk about who exactly was Ken Christensen.
Kenny Christensen was a guy who was, he was born in Minnesota, in Morris, Minnesota. He was kind of a farm boy, grew up during the Depression. He dropped out of high school in his senior year and joined the Army paratroopers and jumped for them, mostly in Japan, though, because by the time he actually saw action, the war had just ended. But he was part of the occupation force. After the war was over, he got out, and then he went to work for Northwest Airlines up on Shemya Island in the Aleutians, servicing planes. And most people were there for maybe a year. He was there for almost 5 years. And he took a couple of jobs after that, but he ended up back with Northwest as a purser, serving out of the Seattle hub. And basically that's where he worked until he retired.
And so what I find particularly interesting about him is this fact that he was a paratrooper.
Yes. He was a paratrooper.
Now, So let's get into it. Let's talk about his career a little bit, because usually when you think about someone committing a crime, they have to have a motive. Now, of course, money is one of the great motives, greed. But it seemed like he had a really tough time with his job at the airline, didn't he, in terms of money and strikes and so forth?
On the year of the hijacking, he had been working for Northwest about 19 years. And after 19 years with the airline, he was only taking home about $512 a month. We think that's part of the motivation.
Right.
In fact, we think it's a lot of it. They went on strike a lot at Northwest. I think there was at least seven different strikes between 1960 and the time he worked there. The time of the hijacking, that is. Some of them were pretty protracted. We have letters from him written to his parents where he talks about having to dig ditches or pick apples, work in a hotel as a desk clerk, you know, every time they went on strike. And it was obvious from the letters he was pretty angry about this.
And I could certainly understand being angry about that. Maybe not as much to go hijack an airplane, but certainly. Now let's talk about some of the finances. Since we're kind of on that topic, some of the things that you found, although he made very little, something like an average, I think, of $6,000 a year or less prior to the hijacking, all of a sudden, after the hijacking, these large sums appear. And where do they come from?
Well, we think that they came from the ransom money. The hijacking was on November 24th, 1971, and we have actually documented with real documents and witness testimony. 5 months after the hijacking, he loaned the person we alleged as the accomplice, this person's sister, $5,000 in cash. I interviewed her, and she admitted to the loan. Her picture is in the book, and so is her testimony. And she's the only person that's actually identified the tie tack left behind by the hijackers belonging to somebody, and she named Kenny as the person that belonged to. She did this before I even told her why I was interviewing about Kenny. I didn't talk to her about the hijacking or anything. The first thing I talked to her about, I just said, I'm here to talk to you about a friend of yours that you knew a long time ago named Kenny Christensen. So we sat down. I pushed over a big 8x12 photo from the FBI. Shows the tie and the tie tack that was left behind, and asked her if it meant anything to her. She said, well, I don't know about the tie, but that tie tack, I've seen it before. It used to belong to Kenny. That was a big surprise. And then it wasn't long after that I told her why I was really there. And at the end of the interview, one of the things she told me was, well, you know, so that's where he got all the money, you know.
So in terms of other people, I mean, I know there was a stewardess who saw a picture of Kenny Christensen, and her particular reaction I thought was very interesting.
Oh, you're talking about Flo Schaffner.
Yes.
She's now Mrs. Wheeler, Florence Wheeler, down in Charleston, South Carolina. She told Jeffrey Gray at the New York Magazine interviewed her, and when he showed her pictures, her hand started shaking, and she said she didn't want to say for sure, but that picture was the closest she'd ever seen to the hijacker.
Yeah, and again, I mean, that's another piece, the piece that he was, you know, buying homes and making loans and doing all these things when there was no, you know, legitimate source of income that could be found. Just all of a sudden, he's buying a home and he's lending home money to his sister, I believe it was, and all of those different things. I think that's fascinating. Now, it's also interesting you talked about the selection of the parachute. Now, you said Christensen, or you didn't, you said, but it's been verified Christensen was a paratrooper. And, but it had been many years, it had been 25, 26 years, whatever it was. So there were different types of chutes for D.B. Cooper to select. And the correlation between the type of chute that was selected, I thought was interesting.
They brought on board two larger sport parachutes, they're modern ones. And then they brought one called it's an MB-6. Well, the container's called an MB-6. It's a military parachute. The Navy Backpack 6. And then they brought a non-working reserve chute, chest pack. It didn't work. It was just for training purposes. But the FBI guys were actually the ones that picked up the chutes and delivered them, although they were directed there by the person who provided the parachutes or packed them, Mr. Earl Cossey from, I think it's Sky Sports up in Issaquah. Anyway, he told the FBI where to go get them. They didn't know they were picking up a one that didn't work. But D.B. Cooper did not use the modern sport parachutes. He used the smaller military one. He jumped with it. And we think that's part of the reason, because he knew how it worked and probably didn't understand how the sport ones worked.
And another thing, and the thing that I love about this, what you've done here, there are so many pieces, and some people might say, well, it's circumstantial, but at some point, if you have thing after thing after thing, it starts to become a lot less, circumstantial, and it just looks like you may have found your man. The brand of cigarettes that he smoked and the brand of cigarettes that D.B. Cooper smoked. There's a correlation there, isn't there?
Helen Jones, a lady I interviewed in Sumner twice, I interviewed her in last October, when they were filming for Decoded up in Bonnie Lake, and I was going to the filmings. And at the same time, when I wasn't with them, I was interviewing this lady, Helen Jones. And the reason I wanted to interview her is because Kenny Christensen and the accomplice, the person we allege is the accomplice, Bernie Geistman, were supposed to attend Thanksgiving dinner at her house on that Thanksgiving. They had gone the year before, and Kenny and Bernie were supposed to go that year with Bernie's wife, and only Bernie's wife showed up, and Kenny and Bernie were mysteriously missing, and Mrs. Geistman was very upset. Helen Jones said they came the next Thanksgiving, but not the one of the hijacking. And when she saw Kenny about 3 weeks later in town, she asked him about it, and he didn't really want to give her an answer of where he was. We think they were busy.
I guess so. And the fact that they both smoked, D.B. Cooper, and it fascinated me. I guess the FBI took the cigarette butts from the ashtray. Those were rally cigarettes. And guess what? Kenny Christensen, that's what he smoked.
That's correct.
And tell us about, there's this mysterious picture that kind of mirrors the dress and so forth of D.B. Cooper that was found. I guess it's after Kenny Christensen's death, this mysterious photo that came up. I thought that was fascinating.
After Kenny died in 1995, you know, his brother Lyle flew out from Minnesota and gathered all his personal belongings and took them back. And a few years later, they were going through the photo albums, and they found this picture behind another one. And there's a time stamp on the front. You know, back in the old days, remember, they used to put the date on the front?
Yep.
Well, this one said February 72 on it, but there's a Christmas wreath on the door, and it's a picture of Kenny Christensen dressed in the same clothing, basically, that the hijacker wore, and carrying a briefcase and carrying a white paper bag. And he's walking in through his front door, and he's got a little bit of look of surprise on his face. And what we believe is that Bernie Giesman, the alleged accomplice, actually took this picture right around Christmas, right after the hijacking. The picture was taken at apartment J3 at the Rainier View Apartments in Sumner. That's the place Kenny lived until he bought his house with cash.
Now, a lot of people have said that, well, these bills, I believe they were that when the government put these bills together for D.B. Cooper, that they made note of the serial numbers. So now, weren't people looking for those serial numbers? Why did they never show up if Christensen was going on a spending spree?
Well, there's this easy way to answer that. See, there's a big fallacy about there's a big myth out there about the D.B. Cooper case, and that's that the FBI and Treasury and everybody was just searching for these bills and looking at every bill that came in, and it's not true. What really happened was they recorded them all on a Recordac machine. They got pictures of every bill, and then they made a list of all the serial numbers. But there was 10,000 different numbers. None of them were sequential. And then they issued this, I think it was a 25-page list with several rows per page. They gave it to tellers all over the Northwest and asked them to keep an eye out for incoming 20s. Well, Larry Carr, FBI agent Larry Carr in Seattle, admitted in his 2008 radio interview that most banks gave up looking within 3 months, and all of them within six, because it was just too much of a hassle for them. They couldn't do it. This is like pre-computer days, you know. It had to be done manually.
Right. So and it's not the computer days and all the technology that we have now for these kind of things. So it actually reminded me of that famous book, Catch Me If You Can. If you looked at, and I could never pronounce his name, Frank Abagnale. I can't remember how to pronounce his name.
Abagnale,
but, yeah. But you look at some of the things that he did in the time that he did, which was quite a few years ago, and pre-computer era, there were a lot of things that you were able to do at that time that you couldn't get away with now, interestingly enough. I think this would be much harder to pull off now, don't you think?
Yeah.
Or impossible.
They could trace the money now, I think. Back then it was kind of difficult. You know, I talked to a rep from the Treasury Department in 2009, and I asked him these questions about the D.B. Cooper ransom. He said they weren't even looking, the time.
Yeah, that's amazing. What has surprised you about this case? I mean, we've rattled off a bunch of the pieces that point to it possibly being Kenny Christensen. What surprised you in your research about this?
Well, I would say that a couple of the witnesses that I interviewed, people that knew Kenny really well for many years, didn't really seem surprised that he might be the hijacker. You know, even the sister of the accomplice, the one who received the loan for a down payment on her house, she wasn't surprised. You know, she told me, "Well, so that's where he got all the money." You know. And Mr. Giesman's ex-wife up in Twisp, I interviewed her, I think, six times in last year, and she consistently pointed to her husband, her ex-husband, as being involved right from the beginning.
Now, does Kenny Christensen have a lot of direct blood relatives surviving? And if so, have they had a reaction? We just did a show the other night about Meriwether Lewis and, of Lewis and Clark fame, and people are still arguing over, his descendants are still arguing over whether he committed suicide or were murdered. So if Christensen has blood relatives, I would think they would be reacting pretty strongly to this accusation. Is there any of that?
There, Some of them are a little embarrassed by it, but they're not angry. They've seen the book, and I think maybe they might believe he could be the hijacker. His brother's convinced he is, Lyle.
Do you think that this is going to be accepted as the explanation? Do you think people will kind of coalesce around this theory and this will become the theory going forward of who D.B. Cooper was?
I think he's a very viable suspect. I think what people have asked me before, you know, can you prove he's D.B. Cooper without a doubt? And I say no. I tell them we can present the case. You know, there's a couple of entities out there that could probably solve it. Now recently we sent Kenny's discharge papers from the Army to the FBI in Seattle. Has his right thumbprint on it. And we know there are about 66 viable prints they drew from the plane. And we've asked them to look at those 66 against the thumbprint and see if they get a match. I've questioned Agent Frederick Gutt, G-U-T-T, in Seattle, about the possibility of the DNA test, because the FBI does have Lyle Christensen's DNA to compare. And here's what they've told me. The DNA test that they have to do isn't like a normal one. The only thing they were able to get was some what they call skin cells from the the part of the tie they left behind. And they used that test to eliminate Dwayne Weber as a suspect. But the test is very expensive. It's anywhere from $12,000 to $16,000. And they've told me that unless there's... They have a lot of trouble spending this kind of money to keep eliminating people. The test itself won't match somebody to the hijacking, but it will eliminate them. It's called epithelial skin cell test, I believe.
Okay.
It's a lot more expensive than a normal one. So they're kind of unlikely to do that, but we hope if they do have the book and we sent them a lot of pictures and we're hoping that they'll go forward with it. But they have told me, you know, it's a 40-year-old case. They have a lot of new crimes. You know, they give me a lot of reasons. We'll see what they do with it.
Just a word about Christensen. Was he a happy guy? I mean, certainly he was unhappy before this windfall of money, wherever it came from. Happened, and he expressed that in those letters. Was he happy in later years after 1971?
I would say, yeah, he was. Yeah, he was a lot happier after that. I suppose the money might have had something to do with it. He has an awful lot of unexplained spending directly after the hijacking, but he was pretty careful about it. I'd call him a pretty happy guy.
Now, one thing that was just another one to pick up one other piece. If you see a picture of Kenny Christensen, obviously this is an audio program, so you can't see it, but I do recommend the book. I mean, it's absolutely fascinating. If you see a picture of Christensen, he's bald. The picture, that famous picture of D.B. Cooper, that artist's rendering, which always kind of freaked me out when I was a kid, for quite frankly. But he apparently has hair. So what was the deal with that?
We have an article, I think I don't know if I actually put it in the book, I don't think I did, but we have an article from the Bremerton Sun from 1972 that shows that the FBI was raiding wig shops in Bremerton. The article says they thought he was bald for a while. They must have had a reason for this. Apparently they gave up that idea later. Dawn, the lady that we call Dawn J in the book, she was the sister of the alleged accomplice, testified that Kenny owned a toupee prior to the hijacking, but that she, and he didn't wear it very much, and he never wore it on the job, just like when they would all go out, sometimes he'd put it on.
Right.
But after the day of the hijacking, she never saw him wear it again. He never did.
That's interesting. And if you look at the picture side by side, I've got to say there's a resemblance. It's not one-to-one, but I think there's definitely a resemblance, and you always wonder about how accurate artists' renderings are because, you know, if you ask five different people what somebody looks like, I assume that was a composite that they did. You get five different, but there's certainly some correlation. Do you think that the case of D.B. Cooper and the fascination as time goes on will live on? I mean, we look at something like this, it's, 40 years now, 40th anniversary coming up. And I would assume that there'll probably be a groundswell of interest at that time. But let's say that passes. Beyond that, do you think this will live on like a Jack the Ripper or something like that?
Well, I think it will in the Northwest. up here in the Northwest. He's like Bigfoot up here. He really is. They have that annual celebration and everything. But I don't think he would carry the same weight as, say, Jack the Ripper. But as far in the Northwest, yeah, he'll probably be an icon for a long time to come.
So what are you, I mean, obviously you've written the book, that piece of it's done. What further are you doing in this line? You talked about the interaction you've had with the investigators in terms of DNA. Is this kind of done for you now, or are you going to continue to work the case to try to push to the final resolution?
I don't know how much more we can really add to it. I think from here it's got to be, almost got to be somebody in law enforcement or has more resources to investigate. We've given them a lot of the tools. You know, we gave the FBI the true names of the witnesses, and some of them have come forward, like Bernie Giesman appearing on Decoded. They told me,
yeah, later, I remember that.
That interview only went on for maybe 2 minutes on television, but the producers told me they actually questioned him for more than 2 hours, and mostly he wouldn't answer. And the one that they really wanted him to answer was a real simple one. Where were you on that weekend of the hijacking? And he just wouldn't answer. I've caught him in several large lies. I mean, that's all there is to it. And he hasn't tried to sue us or anything. I sent him free copies of the book. And I you know, when people lie, you have to ask yourself why. Why did they do that? What motivates?
Well, I must say you've created a compelling case, and I think I read somewhere that you feel that you're pretty much 85 to 95% certain, not with certainty. And you know, you look at this evidence. Some people may say circumstantial, but boy, it paints a pretty strong picture.
Well, we have several documents that you know, like from. Oh, his mortgage. It wasn't actually a mortgage. Oh, by the way, the person that he bought his house from was a friend of the guy who we alleged is the accomplice. And we think that Bernie put him onto the house, basically. And, you know, he spent $16,500 on it and then bought the adjoining lot 1 year later from the same guy for $10, which we don't really believe. We think he actually paid more. But $16,500 would have been three times his yearly income, plus the $5,000 he lent to Don. His bank balances never go above $1,000 ever, and he was only taking home about $500 a month. I've actually been in the apartment where he used to live. It's a really sleazy place. You know.
Right, and then he was able to get out of that and then buy a home. We certainly want people to pick up on this book. Can you tell folks, since we have you on the show, tell folks a little bit about Adventure Books and all the other work that you do? And we'll be certain to have links at jimherold.net to Adventure Books website and also to this book on Amazon. But by all means, tell us a little bit about Adventure Books and all the other work that you do.
Well, we've been around for about 10 years, and we don't really publish that many books, just maybe one or two a year. They're more like we try to make them just a little bit better than you'll find at the Safeway, you know, or something like that. I don't know. We're pretty selective on content. We all have separate jobs. Everybody on the staff has other jobs. We're at adventurebooksofseattle.com.
Well, we'll certainly post that on the site. Well, thank you for an interesting discussion. Thank you for the hard work that you've done on this case. I guess we can't say case closed, but we can say certainly getting there, maybe. And the book is Into the Blast, The True Story of D.B. Cooper. Our guest tonight was Robert Blevins. And Robert, we thank you so much for being on the program.
Well, I'm glad you had me on, and I was glad to be here.
And thank you for listening to The Crime Scene. We certainly appreciate it, and we will catch you next time. Stay tuned for more mystery. Bye-bye.